Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by Chess.com, the world's largest chess community. Chess.com recently launched a new way to learn from your games with a feature called Insights. If you visit chess.com/insights, you can get detailed stats and analysis in any of the time controls you've played and across any time period. What kind of things can you learn? Well, you can learn what time of day do you play your best, morning, afternoon, or night? What part of the game are you strongest or weakest, opening, middle game, or end game? Are you making more or less mistakes than opponents at your level? You can find out all this great info and much more at chess.com/insights. If you listen to this show, you know how often the guests and I encourage getting a coach to improve your chess. But maybe you don't have a coach yet. Maybe it's not in the budget, or you don't have the time right now. Well, my online membership, Chess Improver Monthly, offers a live Q&A group coaching lesson each month from a titled player. You can submit a burning question or even a game to review. And this is just one of the many benefits of joining. There's a link to join the membership in the show notes and on the webpage for this episode. So go to the show notes, then click to join Chess Improver Monthly. Welcome to this week's episode. I'm excited because this is a guest that I've been looking forward to for a long time. International master Krzysztof Silecki. Krzysztof is one of the most popular course creators on Chessable, who rightfully gets lots of praise for his opening courses and his ability to make chess a lot easier for us to understand, too. I'm a longtime student of his courses, and I was immediately impressed by his ability to simplify the vast complexity of chess, even for someone as unadvanced as me. In this episode, we start by covering his chess journey, which is interesting because he got a relatively late start and didn't earn his IM title until well into adulthood. Then we talk about how he approaches creating such successful chess courses, as well as his exciting new update of his very popular Keep It Simple 1E4 course. I'm a student of that, and the original is already great, so I'm very excited for his new one. And just as a reference point, at about 50 minutes into the interview, we discuss some improvement questions from my followers and myself. That covers most of the final 25 minutes of our discussion. And there's some really great stuff for you there if you're interested in improvement topics, which I'm sure you are as a listener of this podcast. Hope you enjoy my interview with Krzysztof. Hi, Krzysztof. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks, Daniel. And you already had a good day today. It's a little bit earlier than on my end, I guess. So you didn't do as much as I did, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, I think we're about 7 hours apart. So I'm only about halfway into my day. But yeah, I'm really excited to talk with you for this episode. I'm excited to have you on the show. I've been a fan of your work for over a year now. As you know, Krzysztof, the very first introduction that I had to you was buying your Keep It Simple 1E4 course, and have found it to be absolutely phenomenal. Was really impressed with the quality of your work. And of course, ever since I started this podcast, I've had you on my radar to be a guest. So I'm excited to finally have you here. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. And I think we first got in contact actually by you asking questions on Chessable, right? I think you had some questions right on the site. Isn't that true?
That's very possible. Yeah, I mean, I ask a lot. I'm just, in general, ask a lot of questions. So, yeah, I've definitely asked questions in your course, yes.
Yeah, I think that's how I first saw you, and then on Twitter, when you started the podcast. It's not. It's still a relatively recent introduction, let's say, or relatively new podcast. Like, how long is it on? Like a year, a little bit more than that?
I guess it's getting near there, but not quite. Okay. Began in February, so I'm about 8 months, a little over 8 months into it now.
Okay.
Yeah, but this is episode 40, so we've had so a lot of shows in that time.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm excited to talk with you, and you know, we'll get into a lot of different subjects that I'm very enthusiastic about to discuss with you. But let's start first with just your own chess journey. You learned chess relatively late for a titled player at age 13, which I think is interesting. What got you into chess at that age?
It is relatively late. Yeah, that's also what I found out later, actually, a little bit when I got more in touch with youth chess, that even, we all know of those prodigies, like who are very strong at age 5 or 6 or whatever. But even, let's say, if you look at youth competitions, they start much, much younger, like under 10, under 8 or something like that, or at school. I learned the rules when I was a little bit younger. I was playing with my grandpa and like in family and maybe with a friend here and there, but it was not a serious study. I was just like, knew how the pieces went. Yeah. But I got more interested into it when there was a school project about chess, and there was a enthusiastic dad of one of the students at school, and he started a group of he invited everybody who was interested could play chess. And at the time, it was kind of a subject among my friends to try out all kinds of different games, and one of them was chess, but just one of them. It was one of many interests that I had, but it kind of stuck with me. I don't know. It's always tough to say how you got into a particular thing, but it fascinated me right from the start. And I started to also follow chess. At the time, of course, there was no internet, and it was 1987, just to get that into perspective. And at the time, I was just like exploring things, getting I found chess magazines that you could buy, and then I was starting. And when I was 13, which was a bit late, but I was of course enthusiastic, and pretty quickly found a chess club, which I joined a little bit later. And then things started pretty quickly, really.
Yeah, okay. So it wasn't long after that point when you were 13 where you started getting serious about chess that you started competing as well. Is that right?
Yeah, true. Yeah, when I was in the club, we had like club competitions and league games. This is a big thing in Europe and in Germany, that we have many league competitions where teams compete from clubs. It's not so much a thing in the US, I guess, where you maybe have some team competitions on the scholastic level, or maybe like yearly things like state championships or so. But we have a constantly going on league, playing like every month you have a game, or every 3 weeks, it depends. And I started with that pretty quickly, and then also started to play open tournaments and basically everything that I could. Yeah, when I was at school, you had a bit of time. It was not so busy compared to later when you're at work and like stressed out. I mean, okay, you have to do your school stuff, but I tried to play as much as I could, of course.
Yeah, and you went on to become a FIDE master at the age of 21. That's sort of like begins to me a period that I find interesting for you in your own chess journey, which is that it was a 14-year period from that point at 21 mm-hmm. where you got the FM title to eventually earning the IM title. Can you talk about that period? Was earning an IM title something that you were working toward each of those years, or is it only later that you decided to go for the title?
It was a little bit odd that time period, because I got that FIDE Master title, which let's say only requires to be above 2,300 when I was 21, and I crossed the 2,400 and made 2 IM norms 2 years later. So I was very close in 1997, and I even had a title application sent to FIDE. I thought I had done it, but unfortunately, there was some really odd rule. I'm not sure if this is still in play. At the time, it was not possible to get the title if you only have tournaments played in those title norms that have double rounds. And I had double rounds in them, 2 games per day. And you needed one norm with just 1 round a day. I'm not sure why this is or why that was, but it was a rule. And
yeah, I was going to ask you why they would have a rule like that.
Yeah, I don't know. It was a little bit, I mean, they changed that over time. At some point, it was also necessary that you have a round robin event in there, and then they got rid of that, kind of complicated. Anyway, I needed just one norm. So I had everything together. I just needed one norm. Like after 1997, when I was 23. And that was also the time when I started my regular day job, like in the office in the bank I was working for. At the time, like for 16 years, I worked at a bank before I became a chess professional in 2014. And when I was at the bank, I was just like, I had less time, obviously. I was just like doing a full-time job. And I was always thinking, okay, I will make that norm at some point and then I'm done. Yeah. But I never made that really this huge effort, like, okay, I have to play every single tournament and I make that norm. I was always thinking, okay, I'll get it eventually, yeah? And it never happened for years. Yeah, I was always just a little bit short, like half a point. I mean, and I was really doing stupid stuff. I mean, I had games that were so awful. Like, I remember one particular incident in 2005, which was like, 8 years after I got the first norms. And so I just needed this one more norm. And it was in the German Bundesliga when I just needed to win one game to get it. And what I managed was I managed to stalemate my opponent like 2 pawns up in a rook end game. It was terrible. I mean, now I can laugh about it, but it was terrible at the time. So I was doing stupid stuff and just not doing the right things. So I never got that norm. And then in 2011, finally, I managed to do that, to get that final norm that I needed. I was really doing stupid stuff at the time, yeah. And I had also some other interests, like in the late, in the late 2000s, like 2006, 2007, I was also getting into a little bit of poker at the time. That was a thing that was getting popular, so I didn't do that much chess. And yeah, then at like 2010, 2011, I thought, okay, I need to get this thing done, like get this final norm. And then I eventually managed, as it often is, because that norm, yeah, immediately meant I got the title. As it often is, once you got that thing, you make norm after norm after norm. It was crazy. It was really crazy. Like after I got the title, I think I played 3 or 4 tournaments and I made 3 or 4 norms, which was, of course, not necessary anymore. You don't get a certificate for that because, well, you have the title already, but it's like what I was trying to get for years all of a sudden was just like standard. Yeah. which shows you that many things in chess are kind of a psychological thing. Yeah? If you really only need to do this little thing that you're actually capable of and that you don't manage for your own stupidity or nerves or whatever, once you have, gotten over this thing, you manage to get this kind of performance on the road, yeah. But you're kind of hindered by your own, often it is nerve, I think. Yeah, what was a problem on my end there?
That's interesting, and that might lead into my next question for you, which was, what was the difference or the breakthrough that you felt you had in that last year that got you the norm? Was there a specific area in your chess that you needed to improve on? Or was it, as you were saying, just maybe figuring out how to manage nerves better in tournaments?
Yeah, maybe it was like that. I mean, it was also simply a matter of playing more, I think. I think over this long period of time, I was not playing many tournaments at all, right? And like in 2011, I was thinking, okay, now I will play some and I get this done. And it worked out in the very first thing that I played. That was, of course, nice, yeah, that it didn't take many more attempts. One reason also, I think, was that in 2011, when I made that final norm, I had just started my YouTube channel. That started in July 2011, and that kind of got my, I mean, it's not that I was uninterested in chess, but it was giving kind of a push again, like, okay, I'm doing this thing now with the YouTube channel and let's play this tournament. And I was also covering the games that I played from the event. later on the channel. So maybe this was also giving a little bit of a boost at the time, and you get more into the game again. That's maybe a possibility. I haven't thought about this all that much, but maybe that was really a factor at the time.
That's really interesting, kind of giving you maybe a boost of enthusiasm again for it, perhaps.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, that is a perfect segue into the next subject that I wanted to discuss, which is your YouTube channel. And while I know it's not a focus for you right now, it seems to have been an important part of your chess career, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, and that it seems to begin that period for you.
Yeah, it was very, very essential because we have to go back to 2011, which is like 11 years ago, and which is maybe not something that, like, nowadays YouTube is a total part of everyday culture, right? Like you look for everything on that platform. I think it is, after Google, it is the most popular search engine is YouTube. And at the time, 2011, chess on YouTube was not really a thing. You had only a couple of channels. Probably there were more, but it was just like three or four larger channels around. And the reason why I started the channel was not actually the idea to, I don't know, become a content creator. It was just I was in touch with a friend of mine at work, actually. We were meeting over lunch at work, and he's a good chess player, nowadays a co-author of mine. We have released two courses on Chessable. But at the time, we were just friends, and he said, well, you're a strong chess player, and I like to listen to your explanations about chess. If you tell me things, I understand what you're saying, which is a good thing. Can you maybe explain to me what you're thinking during a game when you play maybe a rapid game or blitz game online? And I was just looking for a platform to upload the videos that I made for him, just for my friend, and I was going for YouTube because that sounded like a good idea at the time. And I sent him the videos and he enjoyed them. And then I recognized that, oh, wait, it doesn't have like two views like I expected, one from me and one from him, but it had like 10, 20, 25. It was in German language. The first videos were in German. Mm-hmm. And it had some views that was kind of surprising to me. I never had given it any thought. And then after like a month or so, I was thinking, okay, maybe I can do that in English and see if more people actually would want to listen to it and watch it. And in fact, of course, the audience was much larger. Yeah, of course, English audience is larger. And the channel grew pretty nicely without really me trying hard. I was just like doing daily uploads of games. And at the time, which is a pretty substantial difference to today, there were no YouTube channels initiated by, let's say, chess platforms, or like there was no channel for chess.com or chess24 wasn't even founded. Things like that wasn't around. So if you wanted to watch, let's say, a round recap of a tournament, there was nothing to watch. So it was just like about private channels. And I did, for example, round recaps for tournaments like Tata Steel, and I had views, like hundreds, thousands of views for that. That was pretty nice. And the relative popularity of the channel, I mean, it was not like ultra huge, yeah, but it was kind of popular. That also led during like 2012, 2013, it led to many inquiries that people asked me, okay, I like your way of explaining things on video. Do you offer chess lessons? And I was, of course, still a full-time employee in the bank. And I always declined because I felt I cannot do something proper like in the evenings after I've worked 8-9 hours, whatever. And so I always said, okay, not at the time, but thanks for your interest. But that showed me that there is kind of a pretty substantial interest for chess lessons. And when in 2014, it happened that my job got, what is the right word there? the bank that I was working for is nowadays non-existent. It is a dissolved company. And that's not an English word, yeah. But I think you know what I'm saying. So I was, I was laid off, yeah, in 2014. And I was thinking, okay, do I get to find another office job, or am I trying to do chess? And okay, I was thinking, let's try chess. Let's do chess lessons and see what happens. And it was fascinating because I had, I don't know, I had 5 students, and I had 10, and I had 15, and I had 20. It was working really, really well. So I had all those people coming to me basically via YouTube. Yeah, that was my starting point to get some popularity. And I was immediately able to kind of, make this thing work, that doing chess as a profession. And I did that for about 2 to 3 years. And that's in 2016-17 when Chessable became a thing. And I was starting to write the courses. And nowadays, everything has shifted from teaching to creating the courses. And now I do that, like, let's say, 95% of the time.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I really love hearing that. A couple of questions for you about what you said. First, going back to when you said when you launched your YouTube channel, mm-hmm. and you started creating some videos, and your friend told you that he really liked your teaching style, that he could understand what you were saying. So that sounds similar to how I felt when I first started learning from you as well through your Chessable courses, and I'm sure, you know, countless others feel the same. Was there other teaching that you've done in your life prior to that, or what do you attribute? If not, what do you attribute to your ability to explain chess well to others?
No, I didn't really do any other teaching activities. I mean, I was always doing a little bit of work with, let's say, the Youth Federation, the German Chess Youth Federation, or the one, not the like a German level, but the level below that, maybe state level would be in the US. I did some work there, but I'm not really sure. I think also it's a matter of experience, right? If I nowadays look at what I have written in 2016, like in the very first things, I also wrote a print book in 2014 and 2015. So I had some, it's just a development over time, doing chess writing. And I hope and I think that is true. That it's getting better still. I mean, I try to always make a new course that I'm writing. I always try to be better than I was while writing the course prior to that. And I sometimes read my older things and I think, okay, it's a little bit better now. Yeah, you need to try to be a little bit more consistent with things and kind of get some sort of narrative going. This is something that I feel is sometimes missing. If you look at chess literature or at courses, that you don't kind of tell the story of how this game or this kind of thing that you're presenting, how this is actually, how this story is working out. Yeah, this is something that I also try to get better at, because sometimes I still forget that. Like, I give some moves and I give some explanation why the moves are played, but sometimes there's a narrative below that is maybe more obvious to a stronger player, but not so much to a less experienced player. Like something that I take for granted, but maybe it's not that obvious. And that I still miss oftentimes. When I look at this, and I think, okay, well, I should have actually explained why we do that and not something else. This is often something where when you look at a position and you have some knowledge of it, like you have played it a lot and you have some other books that you studied before, you have some kind of idea what should be right there, and you just like suggest a move, but you never tell people why it is exactly this one. And you kind of take it for granted, but you don't really think about it so much. And this is something that you still have to tell to people. Like, why exactly is it this one? Why do I put the bishop onto that square and not the other one? And sometimes it only hits me when I got the questions on Chessable, which is, of course, a huge advantage of the platform. If you write a print book, you never get any feedback. Basically never. And there you often get questions, and it sometimes really hits me like, okay, that's a good question. why exactly not this move? Why do we play exactly that? And I never made any annotation for moves because I think, okay, that's kind of normal here, but it's only normal to me, but not to everyone. And you have to really get to the point where you at least give some kind of logic explanation why exactly this should be played and not something else. This is also why like modern courses that I write, and this is also something that other authors do too, they just have much more text.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I think it's, through no fault of their own, I think it's easy for title players to forget how little club players know. As you're saying, what's obvious to you is not at all obvious, is often not obvious at all to club players. And that, as you said, that's coming through in the questions that they ask you, where they're probably posing questions, myself included, about aspects of a position or a line that, you know, you would never have even worried about or considered or questioned. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think, I think you're right that the Chessable platform really allows, I think, title players to start to better understand what it is club players don't know.
It's also something that gets better over time if you teach, of course, yeah, because you get all the questions by students and you kind of get a better understanding for what should be in an explanation and what should not be there. You can also give too much information sometimes, which is kind of irritating. That's also sometimes a bit of an art form, like what exactly do you want to say and what is better not be said, which doesn't mean like you want to trick people. It's just like you can give too much information. That can definitely happen. Like when you say, oh, like here, okay, here there are 10 possibilities and I show you 8 of them, and probably maybe just like 1 or 2 would be enough. And this is also something that has changed a little bit over the years, how I approach the selection of moves that I show in courses. We get there, I think, at some point. I'm doing this reworking now of the Keep It Simple 1e4. What I'm doing now is I'm looking at the old course, as I call it. It's still the one on sale, but it will be the old course in like 3 months. Yeah, I always call it the old course or the first edition. When I looked at the moves that are presented there, I was mostly focusing on the moves that are played on the top level or on master level, but I was not so much giving moves that are actually popular in regular games, let's say, or online games, but maybe are not that good, but they are worth mentioning because they are the moves that are likely to be played in your online game, in your club game, or the regular normal games. And this is something that I do much more nowadays. I heavily use online game databases to check what is actually played a lot on the, let's say, below master level. That is extremely important. And this is something that I didn't do. I didn't even know the resource like 5 years ago.
Right. Yeah. I really appreciate that you're focusing on that because in the courses that I have that do give that kind of attention, I find it extremely helpful because I imagine this is a hard balance to strike between addressing moves that club players will make versus addressing moves that are the best moves that your opponent could make. Mm-hmm. But when I go through courses that only show my opponent making grandmaster level moves, it does often become not as relevant then to my games because so few of my opponents will actually play those moves.
Yeah, it can still be, of course, and you say that balance is, of course, the key word. You want to show often the best moves or the most principled moves to demonstrate also key ideas of a position. I think that is very relevant also for instructive value. But it's also good to show why certain moves are really bad. Like, I mean, sometimes that's not even mentioned in a course. Like, okay, that move is like obviously bad, but you should show why. And I now do that more and more, that I mention, like, okay, here, this is a frequently played move, but it's actually a mistake due to this and that, or this is a typical mistake that is often made. These kind of things, I think, should be mentioned much more in books and courses, just to also show how to punish mistakes by your opponent. That's also an important thing to consider. If you look at the selection of your own line that you're suggesting in a course, that you should think about what are the answers that actually happen on a non-elite level. Because if you only think about, okay, let's say you play a move, and then you look at the statistics and you see that there is one continuation that your opponent can play, and that is a continuation that Magnus Carlsen would know and play, and then he would equalize and you have nothing. This is great, mm-hmm. but it's totally irrelevant for you because you're not playing Magnus. You play like a sample size of people that are significantly worse. And let's say there is this one great continuation that shouldn't be, of course, winning for your opponent, that you won't make a mistake, you don't want to make a mistake. But let's say they have one thing that is okay and equalizes, and everything else is good for you. Then this is a fantastic line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And in particular for regular people. And this is a kind of important to consider, that you should not always look at, okay, what is the best possible thing that they could play? And then you say, no, this is just equal. I cannot play that. This is wrong. Yeah. If like in 60% of the time you get something where where you have a significant advantage, and in other cases you just have a position that you enjoy, then it's a fantastic line.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great insight.
And so you have to, this is like where people sometimes say, you cannot play the Rui Lopez because then there's the Berlin and there's this end game, and this is totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's really irrelevant because that might happen in like 5% of your games or 10% of your games. And if you then have a reasonable idea what to do, it's fine. It's totally fine.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just taking a little bit of a bigger picture and your work with Chessable. I mean, I think most people listening to this know this already, but you're one of its most popular and prolific course creators. Did you always have a passion or love for opening theory? I mean, because as far as I know, all of your courses are so far opening courses. Or did something else inspire your interest in creating all these opening courses?
I was always interested in openings from the very beginning. I don't know why that is. Like even when I was like 13, 14 and starting out, I was fascinated by this. Also the history of openings, those kind of mysterious names and things like that always struck me. I don't know. I cannot really tell you. I was always fascinated by it. But a small thing, I did create a non-opening course for Chessable, actually. But it's not so obvious if you search for it on the platform, because the author, as it is organized on the site, is Magnus Carlsen. Yeah, there is the course The Magnus Touch, and it is a two-part course based on Magnus Carlsen's games for his middle game and end game play. And that is actually one of my most exciting projects, because I got to write the annotations for the games and the selection of the games together with Magnus's coach, Peter Heine Nielsen. So Peter Heine and I, we had many conversations via Zoom and mail and so on. And we worked together to compile, let's say, the best and most instructive games that Magnus has played. And later on, Magnus filmed it, together with John Bartholomew. But I did write and select all the material for it.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's really interesting.
Yeah, together with Peter Heine, it was kind of a back and forth thing. Like he said, okay, we want to have this game in because like Magnus loves this game. We want to have this in. And then I suggested, okay, I have this one, which is not so well known. Do you like it? It was kind of a back and forth thing. We worked on that for some weeks at the beginning of 2020. And it was a really, really fun project. I mean, and super exciting because I never knew that I was going to do that. I was just at the time in January 2020. I was visiting a Tata Steel tournament in Walkensee. That is not so far away from where I live. I was visiting the tournament, and at one point, I got a call from Gerhard van der Velde. Nowadays, he's the CEO from Chessable. And then he called me like, do you have time? Come to this restaurant. You'll meet Magnus's father. We have a project. Like, what? What are you telling me? Okay. And so I went have lunch with Henrik Carlsen and some other guys. And at the end of this day, I knew that I was doing this project. It was really cool because they wanted an author that knew the platform well and was known to be like reliable and so on. I'm not going to miss deadlines and stuff like that. This is sometimes a problem. Yeah. So that people are not so reliable. So I got to do this, and we completed all the work at the end of February 2020. And then Magnus, in the first week of March 2020, filmed the videos together with John in Oslo at the time. And it was really, really exciting because or kind of exciting is the wrong word, because if you think about the timeline of 2020, that was right when the first COVID wave hit. And they managed to complete the videos like one day before all the airlines shut down and so on. That was really tough. Yeah, John was able to get out of Norway like on the last flight before. At the time, there was still Trump was president, and he stopped kind of the transatlantic flights or stuff like that. It was really a crazy time, and it was completed. Just in time, like they got the final takes, and then John left. Yeah, it was kind of
by one day.
Yeah, something like that, and it was kind of tricky at the time. Everything because there was also the thought that I would go there to Oslo for the videos, but it didn't work out because it was kind of everything was kind of falling apart. Yeah, due to COVID, so that didn't materialize. It was a really cool project, and I want to do some middle or end game course definitely again at some point, but there's nothing decided yet. It's kind of for these kind of things, you need to have this kind of idea that you really, really like. Yeah, like, this is a great idea, and I don't have that yet. If I have some, I will definitely go for that. I will, however, say I will present a middle game course in I'm not sure when I will actually do the videos. It cannot be a long time from today, actually, because Chessable has this Create Your Own Course contest. And it's a really cool contest where everyone can submit a course. And it's a competition, and the winner receives $5,000, I think. And the course actually gets video coverage, and I will do the videos. And it's a really cool middle game course. So I will not be the writer of the course that is the winner of that competition, but I'm going to do the presentation on video soonish. I'm not sure exactly when it will be because I'm also busy with the writing, but it will happen still this year, I think.
That course is the middle game course that you're talking
about?
Yeah,
that's a middle game course. Yeah, it's about imbalances, like good bishop against bad bishop, knight against bishop, and so on. It's a really cool course about imbalances in chess, which is, of course, a key subject. It's really nice. I mean,
yeah, that sounds exciting. I look forward to that coming out. And that was one of my questions that I had for you, which was if you were going to do any other courses in the future that wouldn't be on openings.
Yeah.
So yeah, that one.
So this is something that I will present. I have not written it, but it is very well written. It's a really nice course, that winning course for the contest. And yeah, maybe I'll do something that I will write myself at some point, but I don't really have this kind of, sometimes you have, like authors have their passion subject. Like this is the thing that they want to do. But, I don't have that. It's like if I had an automatic, subject to go for. And, it's not like, there aren't any good middle game courses around. Yeah. There's like Chess Structures by Floris Rios. It's one of my favorite, chess publications ever. These kind of things exist. Yeah, there are good ones. And if you want to do something, I would like to have something in a way unique or something that I feel is really presenting something new or something individual to me, right?
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of you creating courses, this is something I've asked a couple of other Chessable authors, but I'm always fascinated by the answer and how they approach it, which is when you are creating a course and teaching it, what skill level do you teach to or are you imagining your student possesses?
Hmm. I mean, what I try to do is if I select the variations that I present, I'm looking at a very wide skill level range. So I want to present like a repertoire and moves that are playable up to a pretty high level, because honestly, I play the things myself. Like I play all the lines that I have created courses on. I have played them in classical games, not so much the last 2 or 3 years because of pandemic, but I've tried out everything that I play in tournament chess, and I do so continually in Blitz. So I think it has a wide range of audience in terms of quality. Yeah. And then you have to think about the presentation style, the teaching style. And I try to make that as accessible as possible. I mean, you have to think about what is the range there? Yeah. It's sometimes difficult because if I say like 1600, everybody imagines something else. Like 1600 FIDE is different to whatever chess.com rapid rating or LeChess rapid rating or things like that. Right. I'm always thinking about like an amateur player that is kind of ambitious and willing to take a little bit of time, because you cannot make it like you cannot get it down to a beginner level. That's really not possible. So I kind of assume that some general principles are there. Like if you have a position, let's say, with a huge advantage in space and you have a better pawn structure and things like that, I don't want to explain those things. I just kind of assume that this is there. And I also want to give this is something that I try to do every single time, because I think it should be done, but I'm not sure I always do it. I tend to forget it sometimes when I write a sentence like, okay, and white is much better. Yeah. I should kind of tell why. Yeah. And I try to do that every time. Now I have not done so in the past, and sometimes I still forget it unless it is super obvious. Like if you are a piece up or whatever, yeah, that's pretty clear. Sure. But, yeah. But if it's just like a positional advantage, I should not take for granted that people understand why this is a positional advantage. So I always want to point out some key elements that I think are there. And I think this is also something that would actually help people maybe to become better players. Like why should this be a better position because of A, B, C, or maybe a certain concrete thing that is now better understood with some variation, then you should give the variation. So I always think about kind of the ambitious, like the hobby or club player that should be able to use them. One thing that is, I think, an important point about a Chessable course is that you can, I think, customize your learning experience a lot better than with a book, with a print book, because you can use, for example, you can use the quick starters, which is a compressed version of the course, which just gives you the most essential things. And what you can also do, you can, if you, let's say you look at a chapter and you have like 20 trainable variations, the student can pause some variations. If they think, okay, this is too long, this is not so important, or this is not so interesting, they can just skip them. And then if they do look at the chapter again and learn the lines, it is a little bit more compressed this way. And this is a difficult thing to do in a print book. Of course, you can, in a print book, you can make notes like this is not so important, or look at this or whatever. You can write stuff in the book. But that's much more customizable, I think. This is also something to keep in mind. If I go a little bit deeper sometimes in a course, I kind of assume that if the student thinks this is really too much for them, they could actually just pause the variation.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly how I use the courses. I always start with a quick starter. That's my go-to. I go through that first thoroughly.
Yeah.
And then I add lines. I go into the chapters for other lines as I see them in my game. So if I come across it and it's in one of the other chapters, then I study it and learn it and it gets added to what I'm studying.
Yeah.
To kind of bring it back to a topic we touched on a little bit earlier, this December, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you said you'll be releasing new revised edition of Keep It Simple 1E4, which is very exciting. What inspired you to release a new version?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. First of all, you have to think about the first edition and evaluate it properly. It was released in March 2018. So 4.5 years ago, and most of it was written in 2017 even. Yeah, I started in 2017. And there have been quite significant changes in those, I'd say 5 years, to make it a little bit simpler if you look at the time of writing. So there's a five-year gap. And the five-year gap is not so much about that the opening theory would have changed so much in the 5 years. That's really not the case. If you look at like a top level, they say, okay, they've got those neural network engines and things like that. That is not so relevant really for this book. The lines are basically fine that I suggested 5 years ago. However, the 5 years are ever very significant in changes when it comes to the Chessable platform, and significant for my own learning curve as an author. So if you look at this like 5 years ago, Chessable had not yet implemented many things, many functions that are now on the site. For example, when the course was written, nowadays we have those so-called clickable lines, like you have a text and then you can give some moves in the text that you can click on and it would be shown on the board. That was not even technically possible in 2018. So I did not write the course with this functionality in mind because it didn't exist. So every single move that you wanted to show on the board had to be a line to click through as a trainable. And that made the count of trainable lines in the course really high. It has like roughly 700 trainables, if I'm kind of, my memory serves me correctly. And 700 is a little bit, it's excessive for something that is called Keep It Simple. If you would just take the same variations that are in the course and don't even write anything new, but just like if you would kind of put it into, let's say, if you would just like optimize it for the platform, you would reduce the 700 to like 500 in an instant, yeah, just because you have better technical possibilities. And then we come to what I said earlier, that as an author, you kind of hopefully improve over time. When I wrote this course, it was the second course that I wrote for Chessable and the second large opening. I did write a print book before. That's kind of say it was a second big course because the first one was the print book, but it was a second large project that I did. And at the time, I was not really understanding so well as I do now that you need to have these storylines in the lines. Like tell why exactly this move is played, not something else. What is the underlying strategy? I did that in the first edition in many cases, but not throughout. I mean, you have studied the course, as you say, and you will know that there are sometimes stretches of moves without a single word.
Yeah.
It's just like, I mean, At the time I assumed, okay, like, okay, I could say that the moves speak for themselves. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go there, but you know what I'm saying? At the time I was thinking, okay, I just put the moves and it's good. And the second edition won't have a single move that is not like an automatic recapture without some kind of text while it's played, not a single one. And this is what I want to get at, that this kind of, you kind of tell the whole story. Why is a certain move played? Why not something else? So the second edition will have about three times as much text, I think. Much less of trainable lines, focus more on the most important lines as trainables, and have much more strategy explanation. That is my goal. So I think the two main things is we want to use the platform capabilities in a better way. And I simply want to get more, a little bit more chess instructional value in there, like more text, more strategy behind the moves, and also make the repertoire a little bit more strategically consistent. It was not 100% strategically consistent at the time, because you can a little bit at least make variation choices that are similar against different openings. And I didn't do that in the first edition all that much. I was like mostly seeing it as, okay, I need a solution for E4, E5, I need a solution for E4, C5, and so on. But I didn't really get it to work so well together, so that you can say, okay, we play in a somewhat similar fashion against this other line. There's not so much of that in the first edition, and there will be more of that in the second. This is something that I try to also achieve in the Keep It Simple for Black course that I wrote last year, that has much more strategic consistency.
I see. That makes a lot of sense, and I'm excited to see the finished product with that soon. Speaking of which, I know you mentioned in our discussion before this interview that you plan on creating a lot of new variations. So
yeah.
Maybe you could speak to that. And I also have one self-interested question, yeah. Which is that I really love your Two Knights variation lines against the Karo Khan. Are you still going to keep the Two Knights variation against the Karo Khan, or does that change?
That does change, actually. But it's a tough one. It was a tough one because I also like that line. I also like that. I do change quite a bit. I think I wrote something like 80% new variations. That was kind of my rough estimate. Maybe it will just be like 70, 75. I'm not sure. Now that I'm really into the writing and looking at everything, I feel that in many cases, my original recommendations were absolutely fine, and I don't find anything better. Like, I really think it's fine and it shouldn't be changed. So I just keep them as they are. But I changed some fundamental things, like what to do against E4, E5 with white, against the French, and against the Karo. I will change all three, which is already a lot, obviously. Have three major moves. And I will keep the framework, let's say, for the Sicilian, and only make some smaller changes. Because in the Sicilian, I recommended Bishop B5-based lines, which in case of E4, C5, Knight F3, Knight C6, Bishop B5, that's the Rosso Limo. That is, frankly, just the best move for white, and I keep it. I don't want to change that. I've thought about other things, but at the end, I feel it was convincing already in the first edition, and I just keep it and just have it more refined now. Right? The moves will often be the same, but it will have a much better explanation why they are played. So this is happening for some chapters, and for others, I will just go for something else. And the reasoning is, as I said, strategic consistency, that I feel that there's something else that fits better with the overall spirit of the thing. And in some cases, I just feel like you should bring something new to the table, just suggest something new. And it also has an added, let's say, effect for students who have the first edition. If you have a new suggestion, you actually have a choice then. If you get both editions, you can stick with the old one. For example, I mean, if you love the Two Knights Karo and that's kind of your thing, you can keep it. There is no problem there because you don't have any, let's say, full transpositions between the chapters. Like, it is not a system approach that doesn't work for E4 all that well. So you can easily say, I keep my Two Knights Karo from the first edition because I like it, and you ignore my new suggestion. But maybe you like much better what I have against the French in the second edition, then you pick up this one. So you can kind of, it's kind of a modular thing. It can easily be switched around, let's say.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just shifting now to kind of another segment in our interview, I asked my Twitter followers to share with me any questions that they'd like me to ask you, and got a lot of great questions. I picked two of my favorites from them. The first one for you is from Daniel Ferfaro, and he asks, what should you do when you don't see anything promising in a balanced position? And he confesses that his, quote, dubious solution is to just attack.
I don't think it's completely dubious, because if you're thinking about attacking, that's a better mindset than thinking about defending, of course. That's not a bad idea in general. However, I still would probably recommend some approaches that are pretty well known, but are still pretty valid. So what is often recommended, and I think it makes sense, is to this kind of talk to your pieces approach, like talk to each of your piece and ask it, are you well placed? Do you feel well? Do you actually enjoy what you're doing on the board? Sounds a bit, a bit weird, but it does work pretty well. Like, just check if every piece is doing a useful job or can be improved. Improve your worst piece is a common advice, of course. I mean, it's very, very valid. Sometimes you can really spot, okay, maybe the knight is not so happy where it is right now, and there's a much better square. That works. Even though it's a very popular suggestion, it works very, very well. And sometimes it helps to really ask yourself actively that question, not subconsciously. Sometimes it just hit us, like, okay, yeah, that's not a well-placed piece. But just really ask yourself this question, is this still a well-placed piece? Sometimes you had a strong knight on a square, and then things change around the piece, and it's not so well placed anymore. Sometimes we just have it like in our brain, like, okay, this is not a problem. This piece is well positioned, but things change in the game. And then maybe it's still better to move it someplace else on some other square where it is better positioned. So thinking about the placement of each piece is definitely a thing that helps if you don't have such a clear idea. And also what I also advise to think about sometimes is, are your pieces well organized and covered? It's also a pretty basic thing. There is this famous thing that John Nunn invented, famous grandmaster, that loose pieces drop off. If you have loose pieces on the board, they will somehow drop off the board and get lost, because if they're not protected well, you're kind of shaky. And this is something that is also helpful. Check if your position has many unprotected pieces. And if it has a lot of unprotected pieces, be extra careful and maybe try to improve that a little bit. If you look at games, what I often said in my training sessions is, if you have like two unprotected pieces, yeah, there could be a tactic against you. If you have three, there's almost certainly a tactic. And if you've got four, then there's a disaster is upon you. Yeah, something like that. So that's something that is, of course, very much dependent on the position. Yeah, sometimes it's just like super tactical and it's very concrete, but that would not be a situation that you are the guy who asked the question was about. He said, if there's nothing super concrete going on, like, what do I do? And right. check your pieces. Are they protected? Does it look harmonious? That is sometimes a good thing to do.
I see. Yeah, that's great. Great advice. Second question comes from Simon, and he asks, for adult club players with limited time, do you recommend either 1d4 or 1e4?
I have no clear recommendation. I think you should really play what you enjoy most. It's just as simple as that. It's sometimes an expression in a way. The openings that you play can be a little bit of an artistic expression for you personally. Yeah, like you enjoy doing it, even if you think it's not so great. Yeah, maybe you just enjoy playing 1e4 because you like a certain thing to appear on the board, or you enjoy, I mean, there's lots of funny stuff on the internet about playing the London system. But I mean, if you enjoy doing it, why not? It's a way to save time. It's not that what I would personally advise, for example, a junior player to do, like play the London. But let's say you are an adult, your time is very, very limited, and you mostly enjoy like playing middle games, playing end games. You can play the London. Why not? I don't think this is some kind of there is no clear rule there. That one thing would be. I also think, like, if you think about how much time it takes to study, let's say E4 or D4, it takes as much time as you want to invest, really. It's not like one is much more, requires much more effort than the other. It depends a little bit on what you choose to play afterwards. You can play a very sophisticated D4 repertoire or a very simple one. And the same applies for E4 as well.
Yeah, my next question is a little bit longer just because I wanted to quote one of your tweets, which I thought was really interesting. And this is a chess improvement question, basically, that I'm asking. But I know a lot of people that I talk to in the adult improver community have it as well, which is about how you use accuracy, engine-created accuracy statistics to evaluate a game. You wrote on this subject on Twitter and you said, quote, accuracy can be very misleading. Playing more ambitiously often leads to more mistakes, but could easily mean progress. I have played perfect games in the exchange slav and drew GMs, but it didn't help my chess. Parenthetical, a small rating gain is not progress. So does this mean you'd recommend not using the accuracy number to gauge how well we played a game?
I think what is missing, you would need, let's say, two numbers. But the second number is not something that any platform would give you automatically, and that is for complexity. If you have a really complex game, in particular, if you talk about tactically complex games, it's extremely difficult to play with a high accuracy. It's very difficult. Let's say you have tactics all over the place. The computer will play, let's say, close to perfectly. It will point out many many points where there were better moves available, but that doesn't mean you played badly. Sometimes you can be very happy if you played, let's say, if you just look at engine evals. So let's say you have three moves. One is like +2, the other 1.5, and the other 0.8. But the two best moves are incredibly inhuman, like very, very tough to spot. If you find the third one and you keep your advantage, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. It might say, okay, that's a mistake or inaccuracy or whatever, but you still did a good job in finding a move. It's a more sophisticated thing to just look at percentages. So very often, if I look at games with students, and I still do a little bit of teaching, but not much, it depends totally on the type of game. I have seen games by students that I really loved, like very well played, that had even mistakes like more than one pointed out by the computer, but was still really, really well played, because sometimes you have like three or four moves, and if you find the second best one or the third best one, but it still keeps the advantage that you have, or you defend kind of adequately without finding the absolute best thing, it can still be a good move. I think it's very difficult to just go by the accuracy numbers. Of course, if you hit very, very high numbers, you should be happy. But if you hit lower numbers, it doesn't automatically mean that you played badly. It depends a lot on the type of inaccurate move that you made, because sometimes the computer thinks the best move is something that nobody would play. Absolutely nobody would play. And this is also something. And I don't really want to go into the cheating debate, but this is something that is very relevant to that debate, because you can hit like accuracy numbers that are really high if the complexity of the game is low. Yeah, and if the complexity is very high and it has very high, or a human hits extremely high accuracy numbers, then it doesn't necessarily mean that it's kind of suspicious, but it would be suspicious if it would happen again and again and again and again, because that's not doable by a human. And for your own games, I would, of course, use the computer in some way, but it's, of course, not everybody has this opportunity, but it's really helpful to look at the games together with the teacher or a training partner that you have. That is maybe, depending on your own level, but that's maybe a little bit more qualified to judge if that suggested computer improvement is something that is like reasonably possible to find for a human player. Because sometimes it's not. It's really not. I'm mostly doing, of course, opening courses. But there are cases where you look at the possibilities there for one side, and I want to recommend, let's say, a move for white. And I see the best move gives you like a +2 evaluation, but you have no clue what's going on. And the second best move is +1, and you know exactly what's going on. It's pretty clear what you should do.
Yeah.
And the +1, for example, if I would like evaluate a student's play, I think it would be great if they play the +1 move, even though the computer would say, the other move is much, much better. And it would be the absolute best, by the way, if that student would tell me, I have seen that the other move might be even better. So they spotted the better move. But I felt that this is too impractical, and I went for the second best move because I thought that it's easier to play for a human player.
Right, right. So yeah, just one more question about using the engine for evaluating games. Do you recommend, in a situation where you're only reviewing the game by yourself and mm-hmm. you don't have the opportunity to review it with an opponent or a coach maybe, or at least not for a while, do you recommend looking at your game, reviewing your game in its entirety, and I'm speaking more in the classical context here, reviewing classical games in its entirety first without even looking at the engine, or would you recommend simultaneously looking along with the engine?
Yeah, I would recommend to do it without, but I know it's very difficult nowadays. Mm-hmm. I know it's difficult. People don't have much time, but if you do have the time, it's the best thing to do. Like without being influenced by some computer judgment, like first of all, at least make some notes about what you were thinking to organize a little bit better what you were thinking, and then compare at the end. I would definitely look at a computer at some point, but not from the get-go.
Yeah, that makes sense. It is difficult to know. I think it's also difficult. You mentioned, I think, from a time perspective, which is true. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also it's just tempting to kind of, it's like a cheat sheet, right? It's like looking at the back of the book and getting the answers.
I'm honest there. I'm not doing it myself, but it's better, because yeah. I mean, I don't play much classical chess. I just play some league games for my club. But usually it's a situation I play that game. I come home. I have looked at it, of course, a little bit with my opponent or with a teammate or something like that. And then when I come home, if I would really, really, really have time, I would like invest an hour or two, whatever you have, and like look at it. But usually I just enter it and want to know if I did something horribly wrong. And right. It's very human to do. But if you have a really, really ambitious training concept, you should definitely first look at it without a computer. That's a very general advice that every coach has. I have never heard anything else, actually.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't either, really. So my final question for you, Christoph, and this has been a great discussion. I loved everything that we've talked about and what you've had to say. Just a kind of a, like, where you are with your own chess life right now. I'm a fan of OTB, and I know I'm sure many listening are as well. So I'm curious what your over-the-board chess life looks like these days. Do you have time to go to any clubs or plan to compete in any events?
Yeah, I'm active, of course, for my chess club. We have like regular club meetings and things like that. I have been also involved in organizing things in the club, so I'm always there. At one point, I was chairman of that club, but I quickly found out that that's not for me. But I'm still involved with organizing things like that. I'm also, of course, playing the tournaments that we that we have like internal tournaments, or we have a, like an open a city championships and things like that. I do all these things, and I play the league games, which is a steady thing that's now coming back to life after COVID is not quite over, but we're kind of getting to more normal times. Back now.
So are those classical games or?
Yeah, that's all classical for the league, right? This is something that is also a little bit of a problem for me, because I'm a pretty big fan of shortening time controls. It's a pretty passionate subject of mine. I'm not one of those people who say we should just play like blitz or quick rapid, but I would like to have a little bit faster classical time controls. And this is maybe difficult, or it's important to put that into perspective, because when I talk to people about that subject, everybody has a different idea what a classical time control is. I was talking to some person who is playing like leagues in Slovenia and Croatia, for example, and they have somewhat quicker classical time control, like 90 minutes per game plus 30 second increment, or something a little bit longer, let's say like 100 minutes instead of 90, but something like that. So that gets you to games that usually last between three to 4 hours, maybe 4.5 hours. But when we play league chess, it can easily get 6 hours or 6.5. And in my mind, that is too long. And I try to, the only games that are that long that I play are the league games, because it's kind of the only thing there is if you want to compete for your club. Just like we only have that time control for league chess in Germany, and you have to play it or you don't play at all. And I want to meet my teammates and kind of have all these social things connected to the games. And I accept that. I think the time control is terrible. Yeah.
What is the time control that leads to typically 6 hour games?
It's not typically, but it can easily get there. We have a base time of 100 minutes for 40 moves. And then additional 40 minutes on move 40 and 30 second increment per move. So if you have a 60 move game and the people use each minute and like you make exactly that 60 move, you can add that up. You have 100 minutes, 140 minutes. So, I mean, you easily with the increment get to 6 hours, and everything that is longer, that gets you six and a half and so on. I have played 7 hours in the league multiple times.
Wow. That is interesting. And because when you said you were in favor of faster classical games, that intrigued me. And then when you said along the lines of 90-30, I was a little surprised, because that's actually the time control that has been, in my experience in the past year and a half, most common here in Chicago in the classical rated OTB tournaments is 90-30. That's most common that I've seen. And I appreciate that. Those games typically lead to, well, at least at my level, maybe a little more at higher levels, but about 3.5 hours
exactly,
on average.
Yeah.
And I find that's a good amount.
I agree. It's a time control that is relatively common in open tournaments in Europe, in particular if you go to Southern Europe, the Mediterranean area, France, Italy, Spain, or areas like Slovenia and Croatia that I mentioned. They often have like 90 plus 30, or sometimes they have a little bit longer, but not much, like for our league games. And that is kind of similar, by the way, what I mentioned with that 100 plus 40 and so on. This is what the people like the top players, Tata Steel or in other top tournaments play. They have those 6 to 7 hours. If you look at games that are longer than 60 moves, it's of course dependent on like with the increment, it can theoretically take 10 hours. I mean, think about the 130, how many moves Magnus played against Nepo in that epic game, 139 or whatever it was. I don't know, 100 something. It was not that much. It was more than 100, right? 100.
Yeah, I think it was over 120.
Yeah, something like that. And that, of course, can take ages. Yeah, it's like every move adds 1 minute. Yeah, two people, 30 seconds. So it can it can last forever, basically. So this is sometimes a difficult thing, because if you talk about, when I say I would like to have quicker time control, I'm actually talking about 90 plus 30, or you can also think about, in some cases, it depends on the tournament format. I also think like 60 plus 30 can be fine. Why not? If you want to play, let's say, two games per day and you have 60 plus 30, why not? Is that going to be a terribly bad game? The difference between 60 and 90 minutes is, of course, there, but it's not like it's a totally different animal. So something like that, I feel, would be an appropriate, for me, appropriate thing. I'm not a fan of doing the 6-7 hour thing. In particular, if you think about, which is not happening so much like in the US and in other countries, but in league games in Germany, you also have to consider you could have an away game where you drive to the place for 2 hours first.
Right. Yeah.
Like 2 hours drive, 7 hour playing, 2 hours back, and then your day is kind of, you don't want to do anything. Yeah, you're kind of done.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So this is something that I like to do, and this is also why, when you were coming from that, how is my own OTB chess looking like? If I play a tournament, I want it to not last 6 hours per game. So I'm kind of looking for tournaments that are kind of around that somewhat quicker time control. And I also look for tournaments that offer me a little bit more than just the games, like a place that is interesting to visit or something like that. I'd like to have a little bit more on top. Like I selected most of my tournaments before the pandemic, mostly due to me being interested in the places. I've went to Spain, to Poland, Slovenia, and so on, just to visit some interesting places. Yeah, that's also, I think, an important part for everybody when they select their chess. I mean, maybe not everybody, but at least for me, I'd like to look at some new places, do a little bit of sightseeing, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great point. And total agreement on shortening time controls to something around 90-30. I think that's sort of an ideal length. But Christoph, it was fantastic talking with you. I really appreciate all your time. I know we went a little long today, but it was a great discussion.
I didn't have a look, actually. It's a little bit longer, yeah, but it tends to happen. Yeah, I tend to also fall into monologues. I'm sorry about that, but something happens.
No, it's all interesting stuff that you had to say, and I always appreciate when a guest has a lot to say. So it's totally fine and encouraged. So I just want to thank you for your time and all the wisdom that you shared today. And I'm excited about your new Keep It Simple 1e4 update and the new version of that course. I will definitely be buying that and looking forward to it. But again, thank you so much, Christoph. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. I was happy to be on your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. And wishing you all the best with more courses from Chessable. I always look forward to each new one that you put out. And just wishing you much success in everything you do.
Yeah, thank you. To you as well.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of my business, Adult Chess Academy. And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.